My Mac Podcast number 124. It is the DRM Free Zone. Yeah. That was stupid.
The next generation of radio. It's the MyMac.com podcast.
And Chad Perry's here in the studio with me. Hi, Chad.
Hello, Tim. And Guy Searle is with us over in Old Virginny. Hello, Guy.
Hello there, guys.
And we have another guest today.
Fresh from the West Coast?
That's right.
Hey, Bakari, what's going on?
Doing good. Glad to be here. Great.
Hey, we're coming at you from all sides.
A little today. Nervous.
Yeah, we've pretty much got the middle of the country and the left and the right coast all representing.
Yep.
But don't consider me a Republican. Represent.
No, me either.
So a lot of Mac news this last week. Of course, we released the last show on Monday morning, and actually it was posted Sunday night, but you know, it was dated for Monday morning. And then Monday we have all this great big huge iTunes Apple EMI news.
My
boy, were we it's like we got caught flat-footed. The news came out, we've got a new show and people download it, they can
yep.
Oh, maybe they'll be talking about the EMI DRM deal
and no.
So who you want to bring us up to date, Guy?
Yeah, well, you know, I can't believe nobody doesn't already know about this, but EMI and Apple have come to an agreement to release EMI's entire catalog without DRM.
Sweet.
Very sweet. Now, of course, this comes at a slightly higher price.
A premium price.
Yeah, but along with that that no DRM pledge, you're also getting it at $256K as compared to $128K of the nasty DRM kind.
You know, it's only 30 cents a song, and you do they're giving you the opportunity to buy the DRM free one for an extra 30 cents for anything that you've already bought from EMI.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's a nice
smaller
touch.
Labels.
That is nice.
I kind of wonder how that's going to work. Will it delete your DRM'd one, and then you only have the non-DRM copy, or will you have two versions of that now? One. With DRM, one without DRM. I don't think it's going to delete your old stuff.
I haven't
probably
tried it
not.
Yet.
I don't even know.
It hasn't been released yet. We've got another month before.
That's not till May. Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's a lot of stuff that they have to encode. But I have heard some message board postings. Well, I haven't heard them. I've read them.
you read them.
That a lot of people are asking the question, well, is 256 significantly better quality? Yeah, it's more bit rates, but is it a better quality than the 128? Does it sound twice as good? Well, yes, it sounds better, but is it twice as good? No, probably not.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how you would quantify how much better it sounds. I don't know.
That's more of a personal thing anyway.
I think it depends on how good your own personal hearing is as far as how good a difference you're going to hear.
I think
what
so.
Did you say, Chad?
Yeah. Yeah. You know what this really means, though? It means Bakari can finally buy a Zune.
Great news.
A dream come true for us all.
He's more of a photo guy anyway.
Yeah.
So.
They're coming out with that Zune photo any day now.
Yep.
So,
I'm not going to do that.
No. So, Bakari, you're the big photography guy at MyMac.com. What you been playing
I'm
with lately? What programs
been
have
playing,
catch?
Been playing with Lightroom and Aperture and having some fun with those.
Well, fill us in on some details.
Well, really excited about it because from a wedding and event photographer, you know, you need something more than iPhoto and Adobe Bridge to really get through some workflow and make some money, actually. And these two programs really help you to get through your projects a lot quicker. So that's the reason why I wrote you guys and said, hey, you know, we need to talk about this because it's really exciting programs, and they're only in the early versions. So, I mean, when they get into, like, you know, versions 2, 3, and 4, there's going to be some really super things going on with them.
Well, what does Lightroom do that's different from what other people or what other programs do?
What does Lightroom do that's different?
Yeah.
Well, basically, I think what they did is try to merge Photoshop and Adobe Bridge and Adobe Camera Raw all into kind of one application so that you don't have to go into Photoshop as much to get things done. You don't have to go into Adobe Camera Raw. You can get it all done in there, and plus manage, you know, the files that you have. So if you have, you know, 500,000, 2,000 files at a project, you can manage those a lot easier than you can with Bridge. And so it's just really in the interface, in at least in Lightroom, is very clean, very intuitive. Not fully featured as Aperture though, but because it's version one, so it's definitely not there. But it's very clean and very intuitive. So you can really do a lot of batch processing, and you can do that in Bridge as well. But it's just faster.
Well, is Lightroom a separate program, or is that part of the Photoshop suite?
No, separate program. It's a separate program, but you can what they call round trip to Photoshop. So you can open up an image in Photoshop, do what you have to do, and save it back into Lightroom, and the same thing with Aperture as well.
You sound like you're very excited about the program. We're going to see some more articles from you on it here soon, or?
Yeah, because I wrote an article, kind of a longer one, on my workflow using iPhoto when I was just starting out. And so now I'm kind of doing the same thing with Aperture and a little bit with Lightroom, just developing a good workflow, man, to kind of get through there and really try to save some time. And that's what those programs are about, is just, you know, creating a one or two or three solution workflow for photographers. I mean, it's really aimed at photographers. It's not so much aimed at, you know, web designers and things of that sort. It's really aimed at photographers who shoot a lot and need to process a lot.
Now, does it cover, like, all the different versions of RAW that some of the different camera manufacturers use?
What do you mean?
Well, as I understood it, some of the major digital camera manufacturers kind of have their own versions of RAW.
Yeah, RAW really is still kind of an open standard that, you know, different camera manufacturers are kind of implementing it differently. So one application that says that it works with RAW images may not work with all RAW images. Have you run into that problem yet with Aperture?
I haven't with Canon. I know that they're bringing on different cameras and things of that sort. So I really don't know the answer to that question, but I haven't had a problem at all. I think there's something which I don't know enough about. It's called DNG, which is something Adobe's put out where you can, I guess it's going to be kind of universal. And that you can do kind of a DNG conversion within Lightroom. You can't do that in Aperture right now. But I think DNG is kind of more of a universal RAW kind of setting, which you can use in any application, what I understand, but don't quote me on that.
Oh, too late. You're on the podcast saying it.
Yeah, excerpt that out. Just take that out there.
Yeah, yeah, we'll do that. not our style.
So what else you been playing with, Bakari?
That's about it, really. Just trying to get my head into those. If you are a photographer and you haven't tried these two applications, really, I mean, download the trial versions. I think Aperture, to me, you know, being an Apple person and everything, I think it's better. It's not as intuitive as Lightroom, but the smart folder features in Aperture just makes it a lot faster than Lightroom. Lightroom doesn't have that. It has some thing called quick collections, but it's just not
up the same par thing.
With the, you know, no. Not up to par with Aperture smart folders. Just like in iPhoto, you have the smart folders as well. So when you set those parameters, you know, you're constantly, you know, changing your ratings or changing the type of things you do with your photos, and so those smart folders get automatically updated. And so when you get ready to output, you know, your stuff is already set into folders, and so it's really much easier. And they just don't have that in Lightroom. You have to still do a lot of manual folder setting up and updating.
So you think that Lightroom's ahead or behind at this point?
It's behind. It's still behind, but it's. You know, it's Windows based. You know, it's the only application like that for Windows users. But at the same time, and it's also that they're trying to really keep it really simple. I think that the thing was they don't want to make it too complicated like Photoshop, where you have to, you know, read three or four books in order to understand it. I think you can almost get into Photoshop without reading almost anything, and get going. Get into Lightroom. And so I think they're trying to simplify it, but it it needs a version, you know, 1.5 to, you know, to kind of deal with some problem, deal with some management problems. And there have been complaints about that. I've been talking to people on different threads, and they've had the same complaint that the digital management is not quite up to snuff. No, it's missing. And so they're going to need to do that. I'm not sure they're going to. I'm not sure. Can they bring in smart folders, or is that something that's copyrighted to Apple?
I think that's an Apple thing.
Yeah. So I don't know what they're going to do to replace that, but that Apple's ahead on that game. So to me, that's the difference. Now, but what Lightroom has, though, it has a thing called presets where you can kind of do some presetted kind of color correction stuff or enhancement that you can do in Lightroom a lot easier than you can in Aperture. Aperture has presets, but they're not as easy to do or as intuitive as Lightroom. So Lightroom has is ahead on that.
Has Lightroom been released from beta? Is it a standalone project?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think about a month or so or more.
Oh, okay. I don't know.
A little over a month it has been. But you still can get the 30, I think they still get the 30-day trial version and check it out. And it's sweet. I mean, right now I think it was $200 up until April the 30th, and then now I think it's $300. I think it's about, so Apple, I mean, Aperture and Lightroom about the same price. Which, you know, it's still a good price if you're a photographer and you're doing it for your business. It's a money saver.
Well, Bakari, we want to thank you for coming on the show today. We definitely want to get you back on, and I apologize to all the listeners. We're getting a little bit of feedback bleeding through, but thanks a lot for coming on today, Bakari.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I appreciate it. It's really fun. You guys are just, you know, you got me a little scared to come on with you guys. Such so technical, man.
It's not making it through here. Yeah.
we're easy to get along with.
I mean, my heart's not beating as much as it was, you know.
Yeah. Well, we don't want to keep you on the show the whole show. Unfortunately, you keep breaking out on us. So.
Oh, that's no problem.
But we do appreciate you coming on, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, man. Thanks a lot. Take care, guys.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye, Bakari.
I hate to have to get rid of Bakari like that, but it keeps cutting in and out, and it's this wasn't working very well. Though, I mean, the internet is such a finicky thing sometimes, you know.
I know.
An hour from now, it may have been okay, but you know,
exactly. Right. Everybody's downloading trailers right now from work on the West Coast because you know they're getting ready to go home, and oh, we'll download all these things right.
May as well see how my stocks are doing today
for the fourth time.
So, we're going to try to plug up the pipes.
So jumping into some Macintosh and Apple news, who wants to take the first story?
I'll take this one because I think it's good. European Union irked at Apple, but they agree that it's not Apple's fault.
Yeah.
So essentially, I'll go ahead and read you the story. The European Union is still mad at Apple over different prices between members of the EU. Oddly enough, the same regulators acknowledge that this is mostly the fault of the record companies that supply the content, but hold on to the copyrights of the songs they provide to Apple for iTunes. Essentially, EU constituents are only able to buy content from iTunes at the store labeled for the country of origin of the credit card used to buy the content. The prices and even the available content fluctuate from different countries or stores.
You know, Apple is perfectly capable of having just one iTunes store available worldwide, but it's the record companies that won't let them do it.
Well, they regulate the content. You know, exactly. It's not up to Apple.
No. But do you think, though, that this whole deal with EMI to get DRM-free music into the iTunes music store, do you think that's a step towards more of a unified iTunes music store experience for the whole world rather than just, you know, each country gets their own.
Well, and the other thing is you don't know what the copyright laws are for the individual country, because every country, I'm sure, has record labels and record studios that manage their talent.
But don't you think it's time that this sort of thing gets worked out on an international level?
Well, it should. That,
you know, this is international commerce. It's not like we're sending nuclear bombs or nuclear material to another country.
Right.
This is literally selling music.
Mm-hmm.
It should just be data.
Yeah, it's exactly.
Right.
And, you know, it's not like even we're sending a physical CD somewhere. But then why couldn't we? Why can't I send a CD that I buy here to David Cohen in England? I can legally.
Right.
Even if he can't legally buy it in England because it's not for sale there. I should be able to send it to him. It'd work on any CD player.
Sure.
Well, the iTunes Music Store should work exactly the same. Everybody should see the same type of music. That's not to say that everyone's experience would be exactly the same, because, you know, if it's the iTunes Music Store in Japan, they probably don't care about, you know, the free single of the week here in the United States, because it's going to be English, where they would want, you know, their own language.
Music.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and I think even in a broader perspective, I think, you know, we need to open up the discussion of universal formats for things like DVDs and, you know, think about the old VHS. There were two different standards for VHS, at least. There's a U.S. standard and there's a European standard.
Well, there is for television as well.
Yeah, for television and broadcast in general, there's two standards.
Yeah, so, but who's going to be in charge of the standard, though? So, I mean, that's a slippery slope.
We are
going down that. Well, a lot of people think that the United States already has too much control over the internet, even though we invented it. But
let me think about that. Too bad.
Too bad. Well, what other country could run it as well as the United States has? I don't think anybody could.
Right? No, I think it's working out pretty well.
I think it's just fine. I don't see anything really broken with the internet right now. Spam, sure, but you can't regulate that anyway.
You can't regulate it. I mean, it's going to happen no matter what you do.
Well, the internet's based on open standards.
That's right.
And it was originally designed as a trusted network. If you're on this network, you're obviously trustworthy. You get access to the information.
Oh, how the times have changed.
Well, it was after the fact that they started trying to get in and implement the different security protocols. And there's just no way that I can see to stop spam. How do you stop it?
You can't.
You can't. Because if you start instituting so many filters where you have to approve every message coming in, nobody wants to do that.
And you'd never get anything else done.
Exactly. Right. It's never going to work having a system set up that says, hey, only the people on this list can send me an email. Because what if someone that's not on the email list wants to send you something? Then they can't. It just wouldn't work. So
then they call you on the telephone. Can I send you email?
Yeah, can you please approve me? So I tell you what, when I send someone
the phone
email,
that you won't answer because it comes up with a caller ID you don't recognize.
Yeah. have you ever got an email after you've sent an email that says, due to spam concerns, you must click this link to approve sending this person an email? Have you ever seen one of those?
Cancel
or
allow.
Yeah, I just go, you know what? Screw it. It's not worth my time. If this person's email isn't set up so I can send them an email easily, I'm not going to jump through hoops to send anybody an email. And I do mean anybody. I mean, it's like, you know, you can either get it or not, but I'm not going to do your spam protection for you.
Right.
Sorry. What's Greenpeace saying about Apple again here, Guy?
Oh, Apple is just not green enough for Greenpeace. They ranked last in environmental friendliness among major electronics makers, while it praised, what is that, Lenovo? Lenovo Group. That's who bought the... all the
IBM.
Manufacturing for IBM.
Yep.
In an updated Greenpeace guide to greener electronics, Apple was bottom of the list for its policies on the elimination of toxic substances and recycling, and scores badly on almost all criteria.
Yeah. You know, the problem with Greenpeace, honestly, is I think they blew a lot of their...
Goodwill?
Goodwill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're
just
almost...
Goodwill hunting.
Yeah.
Cute.
Well, I'm just gonna let it go.
Oh, I would.
Best Buy is going to expand their Apple sales to other stores. Right now, only about 50 stores from Best Buy sells Apple gear. They're going to expand that.
Well, Apple gear outside of iPods.
Exactly. Yeah, right. Yes. Yeah, because every Best Buy has iPods.
Right. Gas station has iPods these days.
And they're going to bump it up to like 200 stores. And I'm kind of curious. I am a little worried that the Best Buys that I've been into that had Macs, the sales staff was woefully untrained on them.
Yeah.
Didn't understand the difference between a Mac and a PC and simply steered all their customers to PCs because they knew it better. So how was this going to be any different?
Well, Best Buy has said that this time they're going to have specially trained and badged employees that they're supposed to be knowledgeable about Apple products and helping customers make Apple purchases. So
in other words, I'm going to walk in, and I'm going to look at a Mac, and I'm going to see a guy, and I'm going to say, hey, can you help me? Oh, sorry, the guy that knows the Macs, he's on break right now.
That's right.
Yeah, not quite an Apple genius, but an Apple savant. Above average guy.
Yeah. Well.
Can I see the Apple above average guy?
I don't know. If Apple can increase their sales by selling more units through Best Buy, more power to them.
Yeah.
I just honestly don't see it happening much.
Well, I wonder if Best Buy knows something that we don't as far as Apple's, some of their future consumer products are concerned.
Well, I'm sure Best Buy knows a lot more than we do, but you're right, though. Maybe they know something coming up that we just don't know, and that's why they want to get back into the Apple products, because maybe it's something like the Apple TV. But yeah, we talked about the Apple TV last week. I haven't changed my stance.
Yeah.
I still think it's kind of a 1.0 product that I really don't have an interest in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It doesn't offer me anything that I can't do already. And I don't know. There's no solution there for me.
No.
Is it?
Not for me either.
No.
You know, although, and here's something that I was thinking about. You remember the craze about a year ago when everybody was putting Mac Minis in their car?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they would hack them so they would run front row?
Mm-hmm.
Well, isn't this the perfect thing for a car?
Well, it's certainly smaller.
It boots, it's wider, though, but it boots up into front row. Mm-hmm. Isn't that what you want?
Mm-hmm.
And it comes with the little remote control.
Yeah.
It's got everything.
Hard drive.
Yeah, it's got everything right there that you could possibly want to put in a car stereo. I think it would be an awesome little machine for a car. Of course, still running 130 degrees is...
Yeah, it's a little warm.
Yeah. It might be a little bit warm.
Come out and your dashboard is melted.
Yeah.
That would suck.
Show it in front of a vent.
Yeah. But, you know, I think that would probably be a pretty good mod for a car.
Mm-hmm.
I can see these showing up in a lot of car shows inside a vehicle.
Oh, yeah.
I just came up with that the other day. I was like, oh, what? Everybody was hacking the Minis.
Except even in the wintertime, you'd have to have your AC running just to keep it cool enough.
Keep it cool enough, unless you lived in Michigan.
That's true.
It's actually snowing.
Then you just crack your window. So.
Oh, you guys got snow today?
We've had snow for 2 days now. It's crazy. Google released a beta for their Google desktop for the Macintosh, kind of a competitor to Spotlight. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
After 2 years of being a Microsoft Windows exclusive, Google has released a beta of their web-based desktop software application for the Macintosh. Reports have been mixed of its usefulness, and a complete list of what application installs on your computer is far from incomplete.
Is that really what you need, though, is another search engine?
No, I don't. Plus, do you really want Google to know, or at least, you know, to have that information available on their servers? Do you really want that?
Well, it's easy to say. I'm not going to play the everyone wants to read my shit because, quite honestly, I live a boring life, and if you want to read my shit, come on over. I'll let you see it. But, you know, it's – I don't know. I think the security concerns are – how many people work at Google and how many people are using their servers? How many people are going to be looking into that?
Thousands.
And if they – well, yeah, but if they ever got busted even once, it would destroy their business. Let's be honest.
It would destroy whoever actually looked at it.
No, it would destroy Google. Google would take such a major PR hit that I don't think they could afford that.
Yeah.
And I still think Google's China notwithstanding, is still a pretty trustworthy company.
Mm-hmm.
Apple, this is probably the biggest news for the week.
Oh, yeah. And,
we're going to let Guy read this one.
Ooh. Apple announces a OptiCore Mac Pro. 8 cores in a Mac Pro tower. OptiCore.
Gigaflop goodness.
3 gigahertz speed.
Ooh. Up to.
Yep. Up to.
Each core is an Intel Xeon, which runs at 3 gigahertz. Many configurations are available, starting with the processors at the low end, which is they still have the two dual core at 2. The mid-range at 2.66 and the former high-end, which is a dual-core 3. You can still install up to 16 gigs of RAM and anywhere up to 3 terabytes of storage.
Yeah.
Base price begins at just under $4,000 and can easily exceed $18,000 with every option chosen, which, of course, I went in and tried.
Yeah. Honey, can you come here for a minute?
Yeah, but I skimped on the AppleCare. I figured get it under 18, you know.
That's crazy.
I know. Oh, it's insane.
But honestly, I don't think there's any application that's going to take advantage of that power right now.
No, not yet.
Well, of course, you know, we got
CS3 is coming right around.
Yeah, yeah, baby.
I think it's cool, and when you look at it, the top of the line is still about the same price as it was before. Mm-hmm. This is the thing about, and it's also true with the iPods. What Apple does is they don't raise their prices anymore. You just get more for that top price now. Mm-hmm. And what was the top thing simply moves down a step.
Yep.
So they're constantly replacing the top line, and everything just follows the ladder. Mm-hmm. And it's usually, on almost every product that Apple carries, it's three levels. You got the entry level, the mid, and then the pro, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You see that with the iMacs. You see that with the Mac Minis. You see that with the MacBooks, the MacBook Pro, the Mac Pro.
Yeah.
Well, everything does this.
There's no mid-range tower.
Well, but the tower,
around $1,500 would be nice.
Yeah, the tower is really kind of the premium.
Yeah, that's
range,
the premium
though.
One, though. Yeah. And the tower really is a build-it. I mean, they have a suggested system, but when you buy a Mac Pro, you really are going to get in there and configure it the way you want. So they'll give you a base price, but the Mac Pro really isn't a...
One shot.
Yeah, it's not a big box reselling computer. It's not you go in and I want the Mac Pro and that's what it is.
Right.
That's not what they're doing with the Mac Pro. They've really positioned it as a high-end machine that if you're going to buy it, you're going to go in and select the options that you want.
Yeah. You're going to lay out that kind of scratch. You're going to make sure you get what you want.
You get what you want.
Yeah.
And I think that's smart. It's more of the Dell type of selling computers that, you know, you can buy a $400 pre-configured Dell, but it's a piece of crap.
Right.
And, you know, if you want a decent machine from Dell, you literally go in and start adding, subtracting, and whatever you want to do, and then you find out what the price is.
And pretty much you end up with what the same kind of Mac would cost you.
Yeah, if not more.
At least now, because these days.
Well, if not more, because if you want the functionality of the software that comes free, bundled with the Macintosh, you can add a couple $1,000 more easily.
Right.
Video editing, DVD, at least of the high quality that you get with the Apple products.
And if all you want to do is get your feet wet and you're a regular PC user, you still can go back to the Mac Mini.
Right.
And start at that level.
Yeah,
and,
$700.
And, you know, with an Intel Core, so what? You can still keep all your PC programs.
And it will run it just fine.
Yep.
I have been running Vista on my MacBook Pro.
How's it been?
You know, it's never crashed on me yet. It seems pretty solid, to be honest. I keep looking for a reason to use it more often. It's like, well, I've got it. I should try to use it some more often. Microsoft sent it to me.
Yeah, but
it's just everything is so much easier on the Mac side. It's like, ugh.
Imagine if they both crashed at the same time, the blue-gray screen of death.
Even window or website browsing, it just feels clunky on the PC.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't feel intuitive at all.
I've never cared for Internet Explorer. I pretty much use Safari all the time, though I do have Firefox.
Well, have you tried the latest and greatest Internet Explorer? Sorry.
No. Not for the Mac.
There isn't one for the Mac.
I know. It's still at, 5.5?
Yeah, whatever it was. No, it's not bad. I'll be honest, I have used it, but probably within a half hour of test driving it, I just went and downloaded Firefox.
Yeah.
And used that. What I don't like, and this kind of ticks me off about it, say I go into, I launch Internet Explorer, and I just type in the address bar, my Mac. Well, what happens on a Macintosh if you do that?
It goes to mymac.com.
Right. Do you know what it does in Explorer?
It tells you it can't find the page.
No. It brings up the MSN search page. It's like, okay, I wasn't freaking searching for this asshole.
Oh, I hate that.
I was going to this address. Even if sometimes I'll type in the address.com, and it will still do a search function instead of going to the website. I'm like, what more information do you need? Do I have to type in dummy.com? Do I have to do that every time? It's retarded.
Well,
and I don't mean that in a derogatory way, because people are like, oh, don't say retarded. You're being that.
Right.
Well, you already said asshole, so we have to go to the explicit label.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I don't care. Anybody who listens to this podcast knows I'm kind of a jerk anyway. So.
Yeah, well.
No, it's just that really ticks me off. And you know what it is? It's Microsoft trying to control your search. It's throwing more ads at you instead of going to the website that any decent programmer knows, okay, if they type it here, they're trying to go to that address.
Right.
They're not typing it in the address bar to do a search. That is so basic.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so arrogant on Microsoft's part that when you type it up there, and instead of going to that address, it brings up an MSN search.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you see? A whole bunch of frickin' ads.
Right.
That just ticks me off. It's like, you know what? That's where their monopoly powers are a problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they get into trouble for shit. And it irritates me. It really does.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have choice. And my choice was, screw this. I'm going to start using Firefox. And then after about 10 minutes, I go, why am I even running Vista right now? I'm not testing it for anything. Reboot, go back to the Mac, and I'm like, oh, that's better.
Well, are there any made for Vista programs yet that work exclusively with Vista?
Oh, no. No PC software company is going to slit their own throat. You don't have a big enough install base.
Yep. Mm.
That's kind of like saying when OS X first came out, was there any OS X major applications that only run on OS X? No.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't until you got to probably right around 10.3 where developers really stopped developing for Classic. They said, okay, you know, it's been long enough. It's been 3 years. We're only going to develop for OS X because mm-hmm. they just don't have the resources to keep developing for Classic Mac and... And it was time to move on. Mm-hmm. And eventually that will happen with Vista as well.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, XP has been around for so long, and it wasn't that much. Vista is not that much better than XP, not really. I mean, they got rid of the Crayola crayon type of interface, the colors. But
yeah,
other
but they
than
jacked
that,
up all the demands for
it's
for
huge.
Memory. Yeah.
It is. When I look at system resources being used in Vista compared to OS X, Vista uses a lot more system resources. Just sitting there, not doing a jack shit. Just sitting
now,
there.
Yeah, but at the same time, you've got a lot of stuff going on running two different operating systems.
No. This is using Boot Camp rebooting into Vista.
Oh, okay.
And it's literally using more system resources than OS X, but it's not doing anything. It's literally sitting there,
mm-hmm.
going doop 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 doop.
Waiting for Tim to do something.
Yeah, you're gonna do, and it's.
Where would
memory.
You like to go today?
It's eating up system resources, and I'm like, what are you doing? Give me back those resources. Let me use them for the programs that I'm going to be using. This is an operating system.
I want them back.
Jeez. Okay.
No, Tim, you can't have them. We're having a social.
Yes.
What are you doing, Tim?
Yeah, I knew you were going to go there. I knew somebody was going to go with
and
the hail.
Figures it was me.
Vista Hail.
Vista Hail.
Where would you like to go today, Dave? I want to go on a Macintosh. I'm sorry, we can't allow that, Dave.
We're not going to let you do that, Dave.
So, okay, what do we got coming up the rest of the show after we've, you know, completely kind of screwed what we've got
off
going
on
here?
Well,
Al?
You were talking
about...
Oh,
wait a minute. We have some feedback. Let's play some feedback real quick, and then we can comment on it.
All right.
Ooh. Hold on. Let me drop the MP3 in here. Hold on a second.
La.
Hi, this is Billy Bob calling you again. And a question for you. My question is, the DRM, now that they're dropping the DRM on the iTunes, do you think iTunes is going to... you know, be able to work with other players? And if it does, will the songs only sync from EMI and your non-DRM music? Do you think they'll be able to do that? That's a question I have. So, if you could answer that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you very much. It's been Bill Bob. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Okay, first of all, I don't think that iTunes is going to work with any other music player.
Well, certainly not for syncing.
No, not at all. I think what this allows you to do, honestly, is to buy music from the iTunes Music Store and use it on any other player you want, but you're going to mm-hmm. have to use other software. Now, these non-DRM files, these ACC files,
mm-hmm.
AAC? AAC files.
AAC, yeah.
ACDC, is that what it was?
Dreadies, Dunder Cheap, yeah.
Will work in any other music player that supports that format.
Format, right.
And mm-hmm. that includes the Sony, because Sony uses the AAC format as well
right.
for the PSP. So, yeah, you could buy something on the iTunes Music Store and listen to it on your PSP now, mm-hmm. which I think is great. The other thing that I really am digging on this whole no DRM, in, at least in for one record company, record label, mm-hmm. and I really hope the rest of them follow suit. What they're going to do is they're going to wait to see
they're
how it goes.
The water.
Yep, absolutely. Oh, yeah. So what I'm really looking forward to is because, as you guys already know, and everybody listening to this podcast for more than 5 minutes, is I am a video gamer.
Right.
I listen to...
No.
Yeah, I know. It's shocker. And one of the reasons I really like my Xbox 360 is it allows me, with a program called Kinect 360, to connect to my Macintosh and literally stream the music from my Mac, from my iTunes music collection, on my Xbox 360. So while I'm playing mm-hmm. a game, instead of hearing the crappy music, whatever the game designer put in here, which in a lot of instances is almost an afterthought,
right?
I'm listening to my own music. Except mm-hmm. it will not play anything that I bought on the iTunes Music Store
because it's
DRM'd and I can't play it. And that just drove me crazy since I've had the Xbox. I was like, that sucks, you know, because I'm getting a lot more of my music now through that.
Mm-hmm.
And if I want to listen to it, and I have, there's been a couple songs. Sugar Cult has a song called Los Angeles, mm-hmm. which it's one of my favorite songs right now. I actually played that for Guy when he was here.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to hear that because it's a song that really works well in a few video games like mm-hmm. Crackdown or whatever.
Yeah.
It's just a fun, upbeat song that really goes well in that scenario. So I had to literally, I hijacked it with Audio Hijack Pro. I played it in iTunes, recorded it in Audio Hijack Pro, and then dropped it back into iTunes. So now I've got two different versions of that song. And I put the DRM-free one, after I rename it and all that,
mm-hmm.
into a certain playlist that's what I listen to when I'm on my Xbox, because that's my non-DRM'd iTunes Music Store purchases. Mm-hmm. But why should I have to jump through frickin' hoops to listen to my own music on another device? I shouldn't have to.
Right.
I can't stand DRM.
Well, how long do you think it'll be before another major label decides to try this?
You know,
I'm willing to bet that it's going to it won't be till after the summer, is my guess.
No, I think it'll happen. We'll see another one at summertime. I think
I'm talking of the four major labels, not because I mean, there's been plenty of smaller labels that have said all along that they'd be willing to sell.
Right, and you're going to see that now
without DRM.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, EMI has kind of burst open the floodgates.
Absolutely, and you're mm-hmm. definitely going to see that. When is Sony going to release theirs? When is Capital? You know, it will happen. There's two things that's going to come into play here. Number one, and I also wonder, though, is when the Beatles hit iTunes, and everyone knows that's going to happen.
Right.
And I don't really give a shit, to be honest. I've already got all their stuff. I don't need it again. I've already ripped my CDs. I've got all the Beatles music I'm probably ever going to want, unless there's a few hidden tracks that I didn't know about. Mm-hmm. And there may be. Will that be DRM-free, too? It should be. That's EMI.
Yeah.
So, DRM-free Beatles music. Awesome. So, what's going to happen, what's going to come into play, the two things that I think that's going to pretty much force the music companies. Number one, EMI is going to see a big spike in sales, and they're mm-hmm. going to get that extra 30 cent per song for the non-DRM copy.
Yep.
Right.
Number two is all the positive press they're going to get for it. A lot of people are going to be coming out saying, oh, this is, you know, I would buy this Britney Spears song. Bad example. I would buy this Metallica song if it didn't have all this crappy DRM.
Mm-hmm.
Because let's be honest, eventually people won't be using iPods. They'll be using another device.
Right.
Maybe it'll be an Apple device that will allow you to use these DRM music files, or maybe it'll come from another company that will be the next big thing in music technology.
Mm-hmm.
Something eventually will replace the iPod. I know for a lot of people listening that may be blasphemous, but you know, who would have said that?
Bite your tongue.
Who would have said that the Walkman would be dead?
Or the Discman, for that matter.
Yeah. I mean, you know, everything, this is technology, is constantly in flux, it's constantly moving forward. What's hot today is not tomorrow, right?
Right.
So eventually the iPod is going to be, no one's going to, ooh, iPod, oh my God, that's so, you know, early 21st century. Mm-hmm. But what about all this music that you bought? Are we expected to rip it to CD and somehow rip it to this new type of device? And mm-hmm. you want to be able to move the stuff
up
with you.
Well, that's what they want.
Of course that's what they want. They want to double dip. But the problem is, if you already own it, and I'll be the first to say this, if I already own a song and I get another device that won't play that song because it's a different format,
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to buy another copy. I'm going to bootleg it.
Yep.
Because I feel completely justified that they already got my money for the song.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I never had a problem with any cassette that I owned that I went and found. I did this a lot with Napster. When Napster was at its height, and you could find anything at Napster, and it was super fast and it was super easy to use.
Mm-hmm.
Anything that I had a cassette for, I felt absolutely 100% justified and comfortable with downloading it because I already owned that song.
Right.
I'm just downloading it in a different format that was more convenient for me. Now, yes, I could have converted my cassettes over to digital.
Ugh.
Oh, yeah, that would have been a whole lot of fun. But I could have done it,
mm-hmm.
and it would have been completely legal for me to do so.
Right.
So why I just cut the middleman out and just got a digital copy. But they already got my money, and they would not have gotten my money a second time.
Again.
Mm-hmm.
If I hadn't bootlegged it, they wouldn't have got my money.
Yeah.
But this is what the bootlegging did for the record companies, as far as I'm concerned. I did go and I found a lot of those, because I wasn't listening to those cassettes at all anymore,
mm-hmm.
right? I just went and found my cassette collection and went, ooh, I'm going to go find these in digital music. So I was enjoying that older music again. But more than that...
in the mood to buy something else. So
exactly. I was like, wow, I haven't heard, you know, this band, Great White, in forever. And mm-hmm. wonder if they had anything that came out after this. And then I went and found it on the iTunes Music Store. I went to the local store and bought mm-hmm. the CD. So then they got some more money from me. They wouldn't have if I wouldn't have bootlegged a song that I already owned on cassette.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that no DRM is a great idea. I don't think Apple really cares if you share your music with other people.
Mm-hmm.
I think only the record companies do because they see it as a potential lost sale every single time. I see it as just the opposite. You know, sharing music
You're getting people to listen to music that they either A, like you, haven't listened to in a long
yes.
time, or have never heard of before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who's ever heard, you know, the kids that are anywhere from, you know, 15 to 20 years old, how many of them have heard of Grand Funk Railroad or Foghat or Bob Seger or, you know, some of the bands that I grew up with in the 70s?
Well, look at that mm-hmm. post that Bill Palmer just did. He was talking to two waitresses that didn't know who the Who was, and he
right.
said, do you ever watch CSI? The Who Are You song? Oh, my God, that's the Who. I had no idea. I should check them out. Exactly what you're talking about, guy.
Yeah.
It's right.
And if you make it easy for people to hear and sample new music.
You give them the taste. You give them the taste of stuff that they haven't heard before because it's all fresh to them.
And that's why I download every single week on Tuesdays. I do download the free sample of the week from the iTunes Music Store.
Mm-hmm.
There's usually one or two new songs every
right.
week. That's how I found out about that song I was just talking about, Los Angeles. It mm-hmm. was a free iTunes Music Store download. I downloaded it. I didn't even listen to it right away. In fact, the first time I heard it was like a week before our 100th podcast at the Apple Store when Guy flew in from Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard it for the first time then. And I was like, wow, this is really good. I had no idea who it was. I had to go to my iPod and look. Sugar Cult, I've never heard of them. And it was just, it was rocking. I was like, this is decent. I mm-hmm. literally went and bought all their albums on the iTunes Music Store. So that band made like $40 off of me
yeah.
because they gave away one free song that I really dug.
Mm-hmm.
That's good marketing.
Yep.
So record companies, I know you're all listening to this podcast.
Or they just heard you ripping about getting all your stuff ripped
free
from Napster.
Yeah, they're getting the lawyers ready. Yeah.
Prove it, bitches!
Let us hear your music.
Mm-hmm.
If it's worth it, we'll buy it.
Yep.
If it's shit, we're not going to listen to it anyways, and we probably would have been pissed off if we had to buy it in the first place. You know? I'm not saying give away everything.
Right.
You know, let's be reasonable. I'm willing to pay for something that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
I'm more than willing to pay if I get a little free sample first. I mean, that's why when you go to certain grocery stores and they have samples,
yep.
how many times have you tried the sample and went, that's good, I'm going to try it, and you go buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Or your local heroin dealer.
Yeah.
The first hit is free.
So, yeah, I'm going to get off my high horse rant now. But
no, too late.
I would imagine, though, that most of our listeners would probably agree with us, though.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're all of a like mind on this subject. Yep. I think we all are willing to pay for music, but we want it convenient. And we want it to go with whatever devices we're using.
That's right. I want it free and clear.
That's right. And I can't tell you how many times.
And we'll pay for it to be free.
That's right.
Are you guys willing to pay an extra 30 cents for a better quality DRM-free song?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So if you had the choice, you would go.
And let's face it, the people that pirate, they're not going to change no matter what you do.
They were never going to buy it to begin with.
Yep.
So
never.
Because they wanted it DRM-free.
Mm-hmm.
Or they just were cheapskates and didn't
right.
want to pay.
That's my point. You know, the hardcore pirates, or not, I won't say hardcore pirates, but the people that never buy music and pirate everything.
You weren't going to convert them.
Right.
No. And you're not going to get crap from them
nope.
because they can always find some torrent site to get it for free.
Yep.
So why even bother, you know, going through the motions, because all the stuff that they're downloading, you know, even if it was DRM, they'll figure out a way around it.
Yeah. I mean, they've already cracked Blu-ray and HD DVD already.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. They've already been cracked.
Yep.
And Apple all but told you how to crack the DRM in iTunes. Steve Jobs was on the stage at the AMI event, said, well, right now you have to burn a CD and then re-rip it back in. Well, gee, thanks.
Oops, was I supposed to say?
Yeah. Yeah, well, think about what he told you. He mm-hmm. told you how to bypass the DRM. Do you think maybe the Apple or the record store executives are like, what the hell?
Mm-hmm.
He just told everybody using the system how to bypass the DRM that we're insisting is in there.
But it's not like it's a secret, though, either.
Well, right. there's a difference between something being publicly known and the CEO of a company telling you how to crack their DRM.
Mm-hmm.
No, that's true.
And that's what he did. Steve Jobs was up on the stage with the EMI executive, and he told everyone how to crack the iTunes Music Store DRM. Burn it to a CD, then re-rip it to your iTunes Music Store, and now, oh, guess what? It sounds probably the same, and it has no DRM.
Hey,
I mean, yeah, you got to go through the process of getting a blank CD. I wonder if there's a way you can make a virtual blank CD. So you can literally...
You should be able to do, like, what, burn a disk image or something and
yeah.
just have it all go to that?
And then you re-import it from the disk image and it's DRM free.
If any of our listeners know how to do that...
No, I'm serious. I would really be interested in that because...
Chad, what's that number again?
1-801-938-5559.
So we want to thank Billy Bob for calling in.
Yeah,
thank you, Billy.
Anybody else? Feel free to call in anytime, and we will play your comments right here on the show. That was actually Billy's second phone in, and I didn't use the first one because honestly, I lost it. I was going to play it, and everything just got kind of crazy last week, and I forgot where it was, and I couldn't find it, and I said, ah, screw it. I can't find it. So, you were going to say something before I really interrupted you a long time ago about what's coming up, Guy.
Who, me?
Yeah, you.
Yeah, I don't remember now, but I didn't want to say I have finally finished editing the Apple Pie
podcast.
Podcast, yeah.
Cool.
I did on March 24th. The wireless microphone I was using, yeah, it didn't work out so well, so I had to do a lot of chopping to get those levels up, and you know, we'll see how much of it that you can actually use.
And
when we're done here today, I will email it to you.
Okay.
Or we'll just do it via Skype.
Yeah, and we'll get that posted up within the next week of listening to this show, so it'll be a bonus podcast. I'm looking forward to hearing it myself.
That was fun.
Coming up on the rest of the show in Book Bites Live, John Nemo interviews author Ted Pandova about his Adobe Acrobat PDF book. And Robert looks at three different products, the LX Triple Display Lift Stand, the Quick Cam Ultra Vision, and the iChat USB Cam, mm-hmm. which allows you to use a USB camera with your iChat.
Cool.
And
you know, before we go, can I say one more thing? I was listening to the podcast last week.
No, you can.
Uh-huh.
Yes, I can. And I was listening to John's segment. He has never sounded better.
I know.
Yeah, I noticed that. His audio quality was fantastic.
Yeah. About last week's show, I did get a couple emails on both sides of the fence here.
Mm-hmm.
Some people were like, wow, that was pretty cool. I never would have heard about this movie production company, Bullhead Studios. Mm-hmm. If you guys want to have this on, I'm going to check that out when the movie comes out, mm-hmm. or I'm at least going to go to their website and blah, 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 blah. And it's mm-hmm. kind of neat hearing about how Macs are being used,
right.
and the people that are actually using them, how a millionaire, a mm-hmm. lot of winner, you know, decided not just to become a beach bum and live in Malibu, but started his own movie company and doing what a lot of people would envision as their dream jobs to do.
Sure.
Yeah.
And then on the opposite side of the fence is, what the hell are you putting this supernatural crap on the show for? We don't listen to this to hear about, you know, haunted houses and what the hell.
Yeah, but that had nothing to do with what the conversation was about. It was about how he's using Macintoshes to fulfill his dreams.
And I got in my Scooby and mm-hmm. Shaggy dig.
Right.
But
the fact is, Tim Schultz was a great guest.
And,
I mean,
yeah, you know, and because he believes in stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
doesn't necessarily, and us having him on the show doesn't necessarily we believe or not, whatever his movie happens to be
and
about.
And frankly, we're not sure whether he actually believes or not.
Yeah.
I mean, he talked about some of his experiences, but he also said that, you know, I could be wrong, but he's doing it because he's investigating it for his own personal
edification. Right. He's got an interest in it.
Yeah, he started as a skeptic, didn't he?
Yeah. So, yeah,
and he still approaches it as a skeptic.
Yeah. But, you know, whether you believe in the supernatural or not, and, I mean, you can lump all kinds of different things into that category.
Yeah.
I mean, religion, satanic stuff, whatever. Mm-hmm. It all fits into supernatural. Whether you believe in that stuff or not, to me, was irrelevant to what we were presenting on last week's show, which is, here's this young guy, he started his own movie company, and he's using Apple gear, software, and hardware to make his dream become a reality.
Mm-hmm.
It helps that you have a couple $1,000,000 in the bank to be able to bankroll it. But that doesn't mean you're going to do it well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the money in the world doesn't mean you're going to do something well.
Right.
If you suck at something, you suck at something. And from what I've seen of his trailer...
YouTube will show you that.
Yeah, real quickly. But from what, you know, from talking to him and looking at his website, looks like he's going to do pretty well for himself.
Yeah, I think so, too.
And I think it's really, I thought it was a really interesting story, and I wanted to try to bring a little bit more variety to this podcast occasionally.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's just the three of us, and, you know, who really cares?
I care.
I do, too, Guy.
I care.
I love you, man.
And on that note, I think we're moving on to our next segment.
All right, coming up next is Robert Hazelrigg's reviews, and then we're going to finish the show out with
John Nemo.
So for Guy and Tim, and I'm Tim, aren't I?
You are Tim.
Well, I'll speak for myself again.
Who is that Tim guy?
Who is that guy? So for the three of us, we'll see you guys next week.
Hello. Robert Hazelrigg here. Today, I would like to talk to you about a couple of items. First up is Ergotron's XL Triple Display Lift and Stand. That sounds interesting and impressive. Well, it is. I am a graphic artist of modest means, and like most of you, wish and dream I could have a 30-inch Apple display, but since I don't have the $3,500 to shell out for the display, not to mention the video card, I have devised a much more economical way to get me the type of screen real estate I need without spending all those big bucks. So, how do you get a tremendous amount of real estate at a budget price? First, find yourself a few moderately priced 19-inch flat panel displays. Bought myself three NEC Multisync 90 GX2s that I bought for $170 from buy.com. Then I went out and picked up a ATI 128 Radeon card from maxsales.com for under $100. Finally, what you must have to make all these things work together is the Ergotron XL Triple Lift Display Stand. The display stand replaces the stands that come with the displays that you'll buy. And as long as the displays you buy have VESA mounts, you're in like Flynn. Basically, all you have to do is take off the existing display stands that are on the three monitors that you purchase and then install the adjustable Ergotron brackets onto the back of each display. The Ergotron stand offers you a lot more flexibility and ease of use than you would normally get out of the three displays with their individual stands. Once your monitors are installed, the stand has a range of motion that allows you to raise or lower your monitors simultaneously, approximately 5 inches or 13 centimeters. It allows you to tilt each monitor individually by 20 degrees. It also allows you to pan each monitor by about 10 degrees, and that is tilting side to side, in case you are wondering. It also allows you to rotate each monitor 90 degrees. The Ergotron stand will support monitors up to 21 inches, so you don't have to be stuck with the 19-inch choice that I made. The reason I chose 19-inch monitors was because I had a goal of pulling this all off for under $1,000. And since the Ergotron XL Triple Lift Display Stand sells for under $300, I was able to meet my goal. The only downside to the Ergotron LX Triple Lift Display Stand is its size and its weight. In order to support the three monitors, It has to weigh a lot, and it does. And for those of you who are working in a small, cramped, or condensed space, it just might not be all that practical for you to pick one up because it does span approximately 4 feet wide. Next up, I'd like to talk to you about the Logitech QuickCam UltraVision. The Logitech QuickCam camera is a USB video camera in the same vein as an iSight. Its size is approximately the size of the old original iSight camera, although it mounts horizontally across the top of your monitor. It has exceptional image quality. The resolution isn't as quite as high as the original iSight camera, but you know what? That's okay. It doesn't take up all the bandwidth that the original iSight camera needed also. It has very good audio quality and some decent echo cancellation built in, and it looks really sharp sitting on top of my three displays. Actually, it only sits on the top of the center display, but it's on top. I know what you're thinking, but Robert, it's a USB cam that doesn't have Mac support. It won't work with my iChat. Well, you'd be right. Unless you installed this nifty little plugin for iChat called iChat USB Cam, which allows you to use nearly any USB camera on the market currently with iChat. So if you're one of those folks out there right now currently seeking old, used iSight cameras on eBay that are selling for an upwards of $200, I would say don't do it. The Logitech QuickCam UltraVision is the top of the line video webcam from Logitech, and it retails for under $130. If you add in the iChat USB cam software, which you will want to use, that's only $10 more. That's still a huge cost savings over an older, used, higher bandwidth eating iSight camera. So, just to recap, today I talked to you about the Ergotron LX triple display lift stand, the Logitech QuickCam UltraVision, and finally, the iChat USB cam plugin brought to you by eCam Networks. In today's podcast segment, I saved you over $2,300. Wow. Well, that's it for me. This has been Robert Haselrig. Thanks for listening.
There's a terrific book called Adobe Acrobat 8 PDF Bible. It's an enormous book. The author is Ted Padova. The publisher is Wiley. The cost in the United States is $45. It's $54 in Canada, £29 in the United Kingdom. We are delighted to have Ted Padova, the author of this and many other books, on the line with us live now. Hi, Ted. How are you doing today?
Good morning, John. Thank you for having me. I'm doing fine. How about you?
I'm doing great. I'm incredibly impressed with this book, the Adobe Acrobat 8 PDF Bible, and let's get to know you and find out some of the things about you and about this book. It does come with a CD-ROM in the back. What's the difference between the written content in the book and the physical book and the CD-ROM that's included?
Well, in terms of the book, there's really no difference. The book is a printed version, and the CD-ROM contains an electronic version in PDF form of the book. And what makes that nice for end users is they can copy that file to their laptops and carry the book when they're traveling very easily, because, as you can see, the book is pretty heavy. And people
it is ginormous.
People can use the search pane and search for areas of interest electronically, which makes it much faster to find information in the book. In addition to that, there are some author-created files and a few sample plugins for Acrobat that are contained on the CD as well. So when readers take a look at certain areas of the book where they can follow steps, I have some example files in there to make it a little bit easier to follow those steps.
Well, you mentioned readers. How much interaction do you have with your readers and users of Acrobat, either in person or via email or in any of your blogs?
Well, that's a good question. And I've written about 25 books, and in every book I've written, I publish my email address I think that's an extra benefit for readers today purchasing books on computers, is that they can have direct contact with authors. So during the life of that book, I see my obligation as not only delivering the content to be published and distributed by online and offline resellers, but also to support users and questions through the life of that particular product. So it's one thing actually I look forward to hear from readers and have some interaction with them.
You make frequent mention of something called the Acrobat User Community. Please tell us, author Ted Padova, what the heck is the Acrobat User Community?
Good question. AcrobatUsers.com is a website that's hosted by Adobe Systems. However, there are a group of non-Adobe people who sit on a board, an advisory board. I'm one of those people, to assist and technically backstop individual groups throughout the world that want to start up individual user groups. And Adobe is going to more of a grassroots campaign in trying to help users become more familiar with the product and to educate people worldwide, essentially, on using more complex software. So these groups are popping up throughout the country and in foreign countries to mutually support each other and evolve with Acrobat and the PDF format. There's a lot of interesting content on the website. There are a number of people who host blogs. There's an Ask the Expert question where users can get immediate answers to questions, technical questions, and articles of interest that provide tips and techniques in using the newest iteration of Acrobat.
And we will have that link on our show notes for AcrobatUsers.com. Well, you mentioned that Acrobat is important to Adobe. Aside from the fact of Acrobat Reader versus the full professional version of Acrobat, can you tell us just briefly why you go on and on in your book about the importance of the whole Acrobat family, the whole Acrobat concept, to the Adobe Corporation?
Well, it's interesting. CEO of Adobe Systems, Mr. Chisholm, made a statement a few years ago that he expected the Acrobat product line to weather the economic storms that software developers may face. In essence, there's sort of Bruce Chisholm is sort of betting the farm on Acrobat and the Acrobat family. Adobe has year over year for several years now found much greater sales year over year with Acrobat than and growth in that product than any other product in its product line, more than Photoshop.
Well, that's going to be a real eye-opener to all of us Photoshop users and users of the new Creative Suite 3 that was introduced today on the day that we're actually doing this interview, even though the interview won't be posted for a week or two afterward.
Yeah, well, Acrobat and the Acrobat family of products are experiencing the most growth of any software application. And when you take a look at the installed user base, there's over 750 million installed users of the Adobe Reader software. Now, that's not
pretty
a commercial
impressive
product. Not a commercial product, but we're talking about more installations of Reader than we talk about any OS that's out there.
Well, when you use Acrobat, the professional version, or even the free reader, there is a help menu. How good is the built-in help in Acrobat 8, any version, and why do we even need a book like yours? Let me just tell our listeners here, this book has 22 pages table of contents, a 44-page index in the rear, giving us a total of over 1,100 pages in what appears to be about 7-point type. So why does anybody even need to wade through such a massive volume when Adobe pays somebody to create a built-in help system?
Well, John, because it's a real page-turner. I mean, it just keeps you awake. Now, well, a couple of reasons. First of all, let's start out with how good the question related to how good is the help menu. The help menu that you find in Acrobat is excellent. Adobe does a very good job, like it does with all the CS applications, in providing online help. So it's there. It's very quick. You can ask for a search and get immediately responses to your search criteria and get some very quick help, abbreviated help, in just about everything that the product can do. In my book, I elaborate a little bit on what that help provides, provide illustrated examples of how one feature or another feature works, and also include some information on undocumented features. So it's a little bit more elaborate, and then in addition to that, there are just a lot of people who still prefer to have a handheld item that they can carry around or browse at their leisure without having to sit behind a computer.
We certainly know about that here at BookBytes, and we are listening to BookBytes live on the MyMac.com podcast. How long does it take to become familiar with the zillions of tools, palettes, and preferences in the professional version of Acrobat Professional 8?
Well, Adobe is on a revision cycle for its software for once about every 18 months. And the thing that I found in not only Acrobat but all the CS applications and the marvelous programs that Adobe develops and we can take advantage of is that I never completely learn everything about a software product during its lifespan. It's 18 months is not enough for anyone to learn everything there is to know about the complex software that's being introduced to us in this very short time frame with every upgrade that appears. When I write the Acrobat PDF Bible, I'm writing it initially during the beta period. It's a 3 to 4 month project, and I'm spending 12, 16 hours a day, 7 days a week for that 3 months, and there's just no way that I can learn every single thing related to that program. And what's interesting is the engineers who write these programs don't know everything about a given program. The engineers tell me that they use my book because they look up certain things in other areas that they have absolutely no experience in coding. I mean, these programs are developed by teams that write certain elements of a given product. So even at Adobe Systems, you don't find anyone who knows everything about a program. So to answer your question, how long does it take? I would say never. You just aren't going to learn everything that you can learn about a product until the next upgrade comes out. So what we can hope to do is to master those features of a given product that help us with our jobs and to accomplish the kinds of tasks that we routinely do on a day-to-day basis and do that efficiently and effectively.
Okay, I do want to remind our listeners and readers that we are discussing Adobe Acrobat 8 PDF Bible by author Ted Padova from Wiley Publishers. This is the MyMac.com Book Bites Live podcast segment. And now some nice, quick questions for the author. Do Macintosh readers get second-class treatment since this book is based on Windows screenshots?
Well, you know, we could, I suppose, answer that question maybe yes, but I would add a qualifier there. The one thing that I have noticed is that Mac users are far more tolerant out there than Windows users. When I wrote the very first Acrobat PDF Bible, which I started in version 3, but the version 4 publication was actually published, it had a Macintosh bias. And you can't believe the number of criticisms and bad reviews that I got on Amazon from all the Windows users who couldn't look at a Mac dialog box and realize that they had the very same options on their computer as the screenshot that they saw in the book. So the next version, and subsequently every version after that Bible, has a Windows bias. In other words, the screenshots are primarily taken from Windows computers, the Windows operating system, And when there is a difference between the screen dialogues and when there is a distinction between functionality of one feature or another, then I elaborate that on that and show some screenshots of the Macintosh. But what I found is that Macintosh users are okay with that. They're more tolerant. They can look at a Windows screen and know that on their Macintosh they have the same exact choices and can follow the steps exactly the same as that being specified by the Windows users. So, John, don't be too prolific with my statements here. We want to maybe hide that a little bit from the Windows users, but I find them to be a lot less tolerant than the Macintosh users.
Okay, well, we'll let the Windows users just enjoy the book as much as they can. You use a very personable conversation style. I want to congratulate you because there's a lot of dense, geeky material here, and your writing style is actually very chatty and very informative and informal. So just as a reader, I actually was able to enjoy reading this book, The Acrobat 8 Bible. A couple of more quick questions, and then we'll have to wrap it up. Can people buy your CD-only version of the book separately?
Well, no. Wiley doesn't make an offering of the CD apart from the book. That's part of the packaging, and they haven't made anything available online yet for e-books and the like, not certainly in the Bible series.
Okay, so listeners to the Book Bites live segment of the MyMac.com podcast can send us requests, which we will forward to the Wiley Publishing Company. Where can we learn more about author Ted Padova and your writing projects?
Well, all of my books are listed on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. And when it is available to be made public, Amazon and the online resellers advertise in advance of when a book will be published. Currently, I'm working on the Adobe Creative Suite 3, and I don't know as though they have an icon up on that as yet, but in addition to Amazon, I have a website that shows my publications and links to the online resellers, and that's west.net/tildeted is the URL.
West.net/tildeted. I'll post that up on our show notes also. Yes. Are OS X users missing very much by using Preview instead of Acrobat Reader now?
Well, for viewing and quite often printing to desktop color printers, PDF documents that people want to just view and take a look at on screen, it doesn't really matter. You can deal with either Preview or Adobe Reader or Acrobat to view the PDF files. When you get into actually doing work on those documents, such as engaging in a collaboration review process and adding comments, which you can do in Adobe Reader on certain enabled PDF files, or when you're filling out a PDF form, then obviously you need an Acrobat viewer for that, and Preview won't help you. So there may be a distinction with the kind of PDF file you're using.
That's fine. We can certainly address that with you, perhaps in a written article at some point in the future. It's been an honor to get to know author Ted Padova. I have about 10 of his books in which he is the co-author, and we're going to be addressing those during the next few weeks and months here in MyMac.com, most notably on the topic of color management and on CS3 applications from Adobe. But for right now, let's say goodbye and thank you for the MyMac.com podcast Book Bites Live segment, author Ted Padova, Acrobat 8 PDF Bible. I'm going to award you the Archduke of Adobe Acrobat and the Crown Prince of the PDF. So that's the award that you're getting from MyMac.com Book Bites Live. Thank you, Ted, for joining us on this conversation.
Well, thank you, John. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks for downloading the MyMac.com podcast. You can subscribe to this podcast at our RSS feed at MyMac.com or by visiting the iTunes Music Store's podcast section. Please send all feedback to MyMacPodcast@gmail.com. And thanks for listening to the MyMac.com podcast.